Ready.
Good morning, everyone. This regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission is called to order. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner Christensen? Commissioner O'Grady?
Here.
Commissioner Musto?
Here.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Here.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Here.
Please let the record indicate Commissioner Christensen is absent.
Thank you. We have the Pacific Horizon Choir here to sing a patriotic song this morning. So if everyone will please stand, we welcome them and the arts into the county buildings. The Pacific Horizon Choir will play at the Farmers Market on Thursday, February 11th, so you can look for them there. Please.
Resources Advisory Committee, from which your new commissioner has come, had a study session with the consultants working on the water master plan for the county, and we looked at the entire territory of the county, basin by basin, and the information they had to date, which raised a lot of discussion relative to things like the reliability of state water and so on. But in any event, we were discussing real numbers relative to the entire county. In contrast to that, when your commission looks at and advises the board on our resource management system findings, you only look at selected parts of the county when it comes to water basins and water supply. You only make findings on some very specific defined areas. And obviously, there are things happening in other areas. Case in point, the Carrizo Plains, where now there are some high-profile projects that may or may not use substantial amounts of water in a basin that may indeed deserve level of 3 severity if it were under that kind of scrutiny. In any event, I'm asking for the voice of your commission to be added to the voice of the Water Resources Advisory Committee in raising the concern that it is time for our resource management system to cover the entire county, at least when it comes to water supply. I think the argument can be made for other things as well, and again, we look selectively at roads, schools, and various other things. But certainly relative to water, because there's already a ball moving that is going to look at the entire county, why not bring it over to the county and include the entire county in the resource management system findings process? There are basins that we have not looked at that way that certainly raise concerns, and others that are in good shape, and we might as well be able to give them a passing grade. In any event, at some point you're probably going to have a study session on this, and perhaps what you can make recommendations as an outgrowth of that. But in a way, it would be better for you to be even peremptory and raise the question right now with a letter to the board. Why can't we look at the entire county for this? So if you could put an action item to perhaps correspond with the board and kind of get started on the right foot, I would much appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, clarification. Are you looking for areas that aren't currently being considered to be looked at? Are you looking
That's correct. The resource management system does not make findings countywide. It makes findings in defined areas.
Because some areas aren't being looked at all?
That's not through the resource management system.
Okay. Thank you. Speaker from Michael Wynn. Mr. Wynn.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm a chair of the REC and a member of the Napomo Community Services District Board. First, let me confirm what Mr. Greening just told you. Although some of that is necessary, some of the omissions are necessary. For example, if we look at water infrastructure, we only analyze the places that have water pipes. No water pipes, of course, they don't get analyzed. Same with sewer systems, schools, and some other things. However, water supply, which is of critical interest to the RAC, in fact, is not covered countywide and probably should be. So any effort you could make to fill in the holes would be very useful. I did want to talk to you also, give you a bit of a heads up. Last Monday night in Napomo at the South County Advisory Council, there was an application made by a Los Angeles businessman named Mr. Brody, to have a minor use permit, which I assume is going to come before your commission, to sell marijuana for medical purposes in Napomo to persons far and wide. I don't ask you to prejudge that today, but in the process of looking at his application, it seemed to many of us that the county ordinance itself is not in sync with state law. The Attorney General Jerry Brown in 2008 gave an opinion in which he said that Prop 215, which established this, gave it some legal standing, only authorized such sales within collaboratives and cooperatives where the members own and operate, and that anybody that operated as a business was in fact involved in a criminal enterprise. That ruling may have been struck down by courts, and your counsel could certainly tell you that.
To respond in some way would probably be best addressed by Mr. Caruso, and what we can do is pass the comments along, and he could probably come to an upcoming public comment session or staff update to update you on that.
I think we'd appreciate that. I would
I had one
some clarification on that.
Along those lines, I was wondering if that could be part of the scope of our item 3 here with the rural area plan.
You know, I don't know, because I don't know how on topic it is. It probably that thought occurred to me. We'll see if we can contact Mr. Caruso. I don't know if he was actually planning to participate in that session, because I know Mr. Wilkin was, but if we can get word to him, maybe we can do it then. If not, we'll ask James to come to the next staff next meeting and staff updates. I have to admit that I didn't hear all of Mr. Wynn's comments, because I was in a staff conversation. So, but I believe that he did address the medical marijuana issue, and we do have a staff, our staff resource on that issue is present, and Bill Robeson can maybe take a crack at addressing his comment if Bill wants to.
Excuse me, I was talking about a couple of points other than the subject you're talking about, but I assume since Mr. Hogue is looking at me, it had to do with the medical marijuana dispensary questions.
Righto.
I think that Mr. Wynn made a comment that the medical marijuana minor use permit proposal would come in front of your planning commission. The ordinance does not require that. It is a minor use permit, so the minor use permit can be processed through our kind of in-house process, which is a planning department hearing, and the determination would be made by a planning department hearing officer. Although we have, on various occasions, on contentious projects, brought those projects directly to your planning commission. So that's something that we can do if you'd like us to do that.
I have a question. If it's done in the planning department, that is appealable to the board?
Yes, so the planning officer, the hearing officer's decision is directly appealed to the board. So it would bypass your commission if we just went through the planning department hearing and then an appeal was made.
I might add, though, that the planning department staff have the ability and the ordinance to elect to elevate minor use permits to the planning commission for a decision. And that's how you would plug into the process if that's the conclusion we reach. And typically, when we've done it, we do it very rarely, but we do it when there's issues of community-wide or county-wide concern that involve policy choices that maybe aren't as clear as they could be because it's a relatively new adopted ordinance or there's a great deal of controversy. And I don't want to speculate at this time, but we will carefully consider whether we'll keep it at the planning department hearing level or elevate it to the planning commission. Either way, even if it's a planning department hearing or at planning commission, the decision is appealable to the board. The difference is planning department hearing means the appeal goes directly to the board and your commission would not be involved.
I guess I would just take this opportunity to ask, because this has come up in the past, if 100 people at advisory council isn't contentious, what is? That's what the Tribune reported this morning, something like that. So I not that I'm looking for more work for us, but I would have to speculate that if this isn't controversial, nothing is, and recommend that would get bumped to a higher level hearing.
My only question was Mr. Wynn's. His specific comment was that he didn't believe that our ordinance is in alignment with state law. As far as state law interpretation, according to Mr. Wynn, is that they're only allowed for co-ops or collaboratives. They're not allowed as an individual business. And I think that's the question Mr. Wynn posed to us.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we probably shouldn't go too far into this since this item is not on today's agenda. With regard to our ordinance generally, Mr. Wynn's correct that following the publication of our amendment to Title 22 dealing with dispensaries, I think that's the word we use, the Attorney General produced a long memo regarding how he sees the law with regard to medical marijuana. It's not the law, it's the Attorney General's dissertation about how he would interpret the law. And that memo raises the possibility for making our ordinance.
And other planning staff updates? I had a few questions maybe commissioners do. Los Osos, Mr. Jansen, want to give us an update on what's happened there since our last meeting?
Are we just talking about Los Osos in general? About what?
No, we're talking about one specific project in Los Osos.
I don't know much anymore than... I don't know any more than anyone else knows. I'm guessing that the Coastal Commission staff is hard at work, those that are still working, and they'll do their best to get it to the next available hearing date. I haven't even heard any rumors about a hearing date.
So we don't know whether that would be a February meeting or not?
I would not bet on a February meeting.
Not on the agenda.
No.
It's
out.
And it's out.
If you saw it by April, I think that would be a miracle. But I have no... I'm just guessing.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for staff? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jansen. We'll move along then to our consent agenda. And does the clerk need to call that somehow or... Not, no call there. So consent agenda, I have a request to speak on item A. So Eric Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and First, let me just say that the minutes are always of very, very high quality. But I guess we're supposed to downsize our expectations of government or something, so I have to mention that up until now, public comment has included essentially the substance of what each member of the public had to say. And if we're starting a new style with these minutes where all that is said about public comment is the names of the speakers, I would hope that your commission might want to weigh in on whether that is adequate. Certainly as a member of the public who believes that public hearings are meant to include the full participation of the public and that information and views brought by the public are important to your decision making and should be an important part of the record of your decision making, I would like to think that our expectations should not be downsized on that and that we should continue as before with at least a summary of the concerns raised and the information brought by the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Any other comments on our consent agenda items, A, B, our minutes, and item one is a conformity report? Okay, with that, we'll close public comment on the consent agenda. And are there any comments? Would any of the commissioners like to comment on any of these items?
My only question is... Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so we'll open discussion on...
My only question is Mr. Greening's... I guess it would be for the Madam Clerk here if we... I think he's requesting more specific minutes that reflect the actual public comment, and if that's something that we can provide.
Sure. We are currently following the Board of Supervisors' minutes, so our action minutes are not verbatim minutes. We move away from verbatim minutes now because we want the public to utilize the minutes on the web so that they can click on the discussion and make their interpretation rather than having written interpretation that can be misconstrued. So we're following what the board does for public comment, and when there are many speakers, we list their names, we say they speak, and then if you want to hear what they have to say, you can click on that item and listen to them and make your own interpretation.
Okay, so the expectation is that people are going online and watching the video,
yes,
rather than relying on these written minutes. And I guess it only, since we've started this, it only becomes problematic, I guess, when we're, it does become a little problematic when we're re-reviewing items. For example, we have one today that we're looking at for a second time. And I guess we would just need to somehow attach or make sure we have easy access to the old tape. Maybe we'll discuss this more when we come to item two. No, it's item one today, where we're actually re-reviewing.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Any specific actions that are made, such as motions, relevant to discussions on your items, are indicated in the minutes. And when I send them back to you for a review and you want them explained further, you can certainly let me know and I will do that.
Okay. So if we want more detail on there, that's something we'll bring.
It sounds to me like it's an intentional deletion to motivate folks to get a real accurate interpretation of what was said at the hearing. So it's enticing folks to go to the videos rather than relying on the written word of the minutes.
And get that full verbatim video or audio and draw your own conclusions.
If I could, that's a very large part of it. The other part of it is simply that to recognize the importance of the public in a public hearing, I would simply like equal treatment of commission dialogue, staff dialogue, and public dialogue. When the public is put in a special category of not giving the substance of the remarks when it's done for other participants, it does not feel like it's a record of a public hearing anymore. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening.
I think we all agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have some changes to the December 10th minutes. I assume everyone got by email.
Yes.
So those corrections have been made, even though they weren't on the originals. So we all have those. Should we read those into the record? Madam Clerk, do you have those couple of changes to note
changes were on your page, item B. The changes were on page B7 for the motion. Commissioner White noted the motion included his name as a second, and it was Commissioner Moskow that seconded that motion, and that has been corrected.
Excuse me, Ramon, I think it was our page B3 originally. B7 was correct in our original staff report. It was B3 that the correction was made on.
Okay, and then we had the one other addition about the item 2, the discussion or addition of the discussion of the guest house on, I don't have the page number, since I read online, which wasn't there. Somebody have the page number for that, the additional discussion?
Just before the motion was made.
That would be, it was on the additional discussion, that would probably be on B4 or 5.
And my agenda doesn't have that.
Apologies, we're reading off of two separate agendas. The online, which was posted by the agenda date, didn't have these changes, and the hard copy of some commissioners are reading did incorporate the changes, so apologies for the confusion on the paging.
Session
just make
that.
Sure we have that addition
I
right.
And Chairperson Wyatt wanted to have the addition before the motion, and I'll read it into the record. Commissioners agree to eliminate the guest pool house completely from permit in order to avoid conflict between proposed kitchen and laundry and guest house ordinance allowances.
Okay. Thank you for reading those into the record. Is there any other discussion on the consent agenda items? The minutes and the conformity report? Okay, with that, do I hear a motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the consent agenda.
Second?
Second.
Okay, motion made and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, anyone opposed?
Since I was not on the commission at the time, I need to abstain.
Okay, thank you. And so with that, we'll move into our hearing items. Item 1, if the clerk will please call.
Here to consider a request by Brad Stahl for a reconsideration of a minor use permit. County file number DRC 0087-0084.
Supervisorial District Number 3, Brian Pedrotti, Project Manager. Good morning, Commissioners. Brian Pedrotti, Staff Planner. The applicant has sent an email requesting a continuance of 120 days for this item. This was followed up with a letter dated January 25th, 2010, which was sent to all of you. Staff is in concurrence with the request, and 120 days puts the item out to the May 27th Planning Commission, and my understanding is that does have time on that agenda, and so staff would concur that that's an acceptable date for 60 minutes, I think, is what we suggested.
Thank you, Mr. Pedrotti. Are there questions from commissioners regarding this request for continuance or general project? No questions. So with that, let's move on. Is the applicant, Mr. Stahl, here this morning?
Yeah, I'm here.
Would you like to say anything, Mr. Stahl? Take this opportunity to say something. We have received your letter as of yesterday.
Yeah.
So
there's two revisions to that I brought with me.
Two revisions. So this will give you adequate time to deal with this and work with staff and the Airport Land Use Commission to try to work out these issues?
Hopefully. That's it.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Stahl while he's here?
No, none.
Okay. Any other comments on this item? Anyone here from the public to speak to this item? Okay, with that, we'll close public comment on this item and bring it back to the commission. Unfortunately, the commissioner from the district is not here today, could usually take the lead on this project. Any questions or comments, discussion from commissioners? So do I have a motion then?
My only question would be if staff has any comments on the proposed continuance.
Brian Petrotti, staff planner, we don't have any comments. We agree that we're going to go back and use the time, have Mr. Stahl have some additional time to review the staff report, and we'll work on some potential solutions and alternatives.
And I think I got the continuance proposed date of May 27th, is that correct?
Yes.
May 27th? If no one else has any comments, I'll make a motion that we continue this item to May 27th, 2010.
Okay, we have a motion.
I'll second.
Okay. That is the one. Do we need a roll call on this? Okay. All in favor?
Yes.
Aye.
Aye. And Madam Chair, for the record, because we continue to a date certain, we do not need to re-notice this project.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I'd also note for Mr. Stahl's benefit that 2 weeks is about the amount of time that we have the staff reports out, and so if there is an amendment to the staff report for the continued hearing, it'll be out at about that same amount of time. So if the 2 weeks is an issue, it's not going to be solved necessarily by continuing the matter unless the staff report itself is revised.
Thank you for pointing that out, Mr. McNulty. So I think we're all hoping that staff and Mr. Stahl, the applicant, and the Airport Land Use Commission can work together to find some adequate solution prior to then. Thank you. With that, we'll move on to hearing item two.
Consider a request by Judith Hassholt for a tentative track map development plan coastal development permit. County file number SUB-2008-00059, Supervisorial District Number 3, Brian Hofstetter, Project Manager.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ryan Hofstetter. I'm County Planning Staff. The project before you is a request by Judith Hassholt for a tract map development plan and coastal development permit for development in Avila Beach. Just briefly, the site is a little over 12,000 square feet. It contains existing structures, and I have photos of that in a minute here. They're planning on removing the existing improvements and structures and constructing a multifamily project. It will include 8 airspace condominium units that will range in size from approximately 600 up to a little over 1,500 square feet. It's going to be constructed all in one attached building that's in a U shape, so it's built around a center courtyard. Again, the project is within the community of Avila Beach. It's actually located at 235 San Miguel Street, which is 2 doors down from the existing post office and Civic Association building. It's within the residential multifamily land use category, located just a block away from the commercial center of Avila Beach. This is an aerial photo of the site. There are 3 existing structures on the site that were constructed in the 1950s, and they're proposed to be removed for the project. This project's also located adjacent to 2 other newer projects, which both have a similar design style, and we'll see that in some elevations to come. But the sites around it are developed. And these lots, just to the back of the property, are all individual lots that are proposed for development as well. One of them, in fact, on the end here, has received approval for 2 units.
And those are still RMF zones?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
This is the existing site plan. This is actually the map. It's one underlying lot since they are airspace units. So this just shows the one parcel and with the existing conditions which are proposed to be removed. There are 3 buildings. It's all on the lower level in between some of the units, and there are also garages and guest parking. So each of those triangular figures on here are a parking space, and there's 13 which comply with the ordinance requirements. I'm going to go through some graphics, some elevations, and a streetscape to give you an idea of what this project's going to look like. This top view here is what you would see from the street. And since it's a U, this part in the middle here is actually set back quite far from, it looks flat, but those cars are not in the front. They're actually on the other side of the property. So that's the center driveway and courtyard area there where my cursor is. And the bottom view is actually the back. It backs up to those undeveloped multifamily lots that we saw along Avila Beach Drive. Let's see, this is elevation if you're looking towards the San Luis Bay Estates, and the hills would be in the background here. And this is the, actually, I'm sorry, the lower elevation is looking towards San Luis Bay Estates. And then the other one is from the single-family home, which is the a white triangular modern home that we saw on the street corner of Avila Beach Drive in San Miguel. The proposed project is a unique design style, and the project architect is actually here to go into more detail about that, but really, in general, the design style was pulled from many other different existing structures in Avila Beach. It's proposed to have more of a beachy, light-colored feel and something more reminiscent of a lifeguard shower or shack that you would find on the beach with the roof structures emulating that. This is the proposed landscaping plan. They are proposing some LID development with the rain garden, drainage garden here. And the center driveway courtyard area will be turf block. It'll be pervious area. This is another view of that. It's a little bit difficult to see in here, but this shaded area shows the one structure all the way around, and the units that we see in white here are actually the lower level. This is another elevation of the colors. There are light colors, blues, and tans and grays, and some more modern design style with metal windows and spiral staircases going up to roof decks. The project does comply with the 25-foot height limit as well. And this is a good view of the flat sloping lifeguard roof that was pulled into the design style of this proposed project. This is an actual streetscape from San Miguel Drive. With the to the left of our screen is another multifamily project, Hole in the Clouds. It's been there for at least 5 years now. And the one to the right is a single-family home. It's a triangular-shaped home on the corner. With that, staff recommends that your commission adopt the mitigated negative declaration in accordance with CEQA and approve the vesting tentative tract map, development plan, coastal development permit based on the findings in Exhibit A and C and the conditions in Exhibit B and D. And we're available for questions if you have any at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Hostetter. Any questions for staff?
Madam Chair, I wanted to make one comment with regard to the conditions of the subdivision. On condition 25, since this project is a condominium, there needs to be a homeowners association And I'm going to suggest that the condition be reworded to read as follows. The developer shall submit proposed conditions, covenants, conditions, and restrictions for the subdivision to the County Department of Planning for review and approval, and then add the following, to be recorded with the final map. The CC&R shall, and then add, establish a homeowner association and provide a...
You know, I'm not sure if there are railings in between. It is one solid structure, but it's... I don't have a roof plan at this time. That's usually with the construction permits. We see that type of detail, but we can ask the project architect for clarification on railings to separate those units up on the deck.
I was concerned about, you know, security and so forth, but then I have quite a few questions here that came to mind as I was reviewing this. Bear with me here. The parking is, well, actually the first one I came to were the Quimby fees, and we touched on that there's three existing units there. Are they three parcels, or are they on one parcel? Or?
They're on, I believe there are two underlying lots, but because they're built over that parcel line, it's considered one.
And would the Quimby fees that are being proposed, would the credit be given for the three existing units, so there would be five additional fees required, or would there be eight required?
We believe that it's the new residences that they get credit. They do get credit for, they get credit for the existing square footage. It's based on square footage, and they do get credit with that existing square footage.
Because if they're in fact impact fees, there's existing impacts that would not be created. So it's only the additional impacts that are being created that are being charged. I see county council.
You know, I would just mention that typically existing units do not have to pay Quimby fees. However, for planned developments and condominium projects, there's a requirement that fees be paid. So it's different than the usual situation.
I guess my question is there credit given for the existing impacts that are on the ground today, or is because it's a demolish and a new planned development, if it's an entire fee as if it were a vacant parcel?
I think it's an entire fee. There's a specific provision in the MAP Act that covers it, and I could read it to you if you'd like.
I'll go on with my questions then while Mr. Orton's looking for that. And then on the parking, I read the breakdown of how the parking was totaled, and I only came up with 12. I mean, it's great they got more parking, but maybe you could walk us through the parking on page 2-3, because the way I read this, I totaled up 12, being one for the studios, there's four of those, that equals four, being 1.5 for the two bedrooms, and there's four, that equals six, that's the eight units, and then it says one guest space, and then one for the next four units, so that's two more. I come up with a total of 12, and I just would like to learn how, I'm sure I'm doing something wrong here.
I can go through that again. I'll do that in a minute. I have a tabulation in my file.
Okay, do you want me to go forward with questions then? Okay. Then the next one regards a roof pitch, and I was a little confused when I read the Avila Valley Advisory Council's letter that they were specifically asking for a 2.5 and 12 roof pitch because it's exceeding the 20-foot height, but it sounds like it's under the 2.5 and 12, so it, are they getting what they're requesting, or are they...
Under the specific plan, it's an or situation. When you are above 22 feet up to 25 feet, the roof pit, it either has to have at least a 2.5 and 12 roof pitch, or the architect or developer can submit a solar access study showing that the additional additional height with a flat roof isn't going to have an additional solar impact on neighboring properties. And so because of that or situation, it doesn't necessarily have to have a pitch roof. And so they've done the solar review, and it showed that a flat roof could be done at 25 feet and not further impacting.
Was that after the AVAC meeting, or was that prior to? Because it appeared from their letter that the architect agreed to do a 2.5 and 12 pitch.
That was true, and it was before the meeting, and the architect did a pitch roof on some of the portions of the building, not the entire roof, but some of the shed portions on some of the articulated sections do have a different roof, and they've sloped those a little bit more steeply to ameliorate some of
those. So the flat roof that's going to be utilized as a deck, there's a parapet wall that slopes 2.5 and 12 off of that for the visual part of the roof. That was one of my other questions, if the flat roof has some sort of parapet around it, or if it's just a rail. Maybe these are questions for the applicant, too. I'm sorry. So I'll
The applicant can clarify that there are separate roof areas. The entire flat roof is not being used as deck. If we can see, there are some areas with sloping articulation that they've added in there. So I don't know if we can.
I guess the question I was asking about.
Looking for a response. Is Mr. Orton still looking for the Quimby fee code?
Yes. Jim Orton from County Council's office. I believe a Quimby fee would be required, and Condition 22 does require it. The MAPAC has a section regarding Quimby fees 66477, and it allows for not having to pay a Quimby fee for economy and project is converting apartments to condos that are more than 5 years old, and there's no new buildings being constructed. So then as far as the credit is concerned, our ordinance provides a provision for asking for a credit, but it has to be done as part of the application and a review through the process, which I don't think's been done in this case. So I think a Quimby fee would be required.
Yeah, I went online and looked up section in our ordinance of 21.09.018, and I'm paraphrasing, it just says something to the effect the divider shall pay a fee multiplying by the number of dwelling units expected to be generated. And so my question specifically was, are we generating 5 new units or are we generating 8? And it just seems somewhat unfair that there's existing impacts if a credit isn't given, because in the practical reality on the ground there is that we're adding 5 new impacts, we're not adding 8. So it's unfortunate, in my mind anyway, that the applicant would be required to pay 8. But
well, I don't think it fits within the section of the code that allows for the exemption problem.
Yes. Okay, and
But excuse me, before we leave that, though, so what you're saying, Mr. Orton, is that some kind of exemption could have been applied for but hasn't?
For any subdivision, you're able to ask for a credit for part of the fee, if you're providing active recreation area, and it has to be done as part of the project application, and it's got to be active recreation is provided, and you know I don't think this has been evaluated through the process and requested timely in this case.
Okay, but it would be an option, so noted.
But that's a different point that I'm making. I think Mr. Orton's speaking of providing some of the intent of those Quimby fees on site. I'm talking about
existing
units. I'm talking about existing impacts that no credit is being given for. Right. And then my very last question to Ms. Hostetter, on page 2-46, we do have the Avila Subcommittee's letter from their meeting of March 19th, and it just ends abruptly here, and I didn't know if there's another page or anything of any substance that we might have wanted to review.
I just included the page that referenced this project.
And
the additional were, it was other issues on the meeting that didn't pertain to the project.
Yeah, I was hoping that was the case. Thank you very much. And that's my questions.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for staff? Mr. O'Grady?
Yes, just a few questions. I just wanted to note that a review of the ordinance has indicated no affordable housing was required. Is that correct?
That is correct. The inclusionary housing ordinance has not been adopted at this time in the coastal zone. It's at the Coastal Commission right now.
Okay, thank you. Next question has to do with safety and security. I'm talking about exterior lighting. On page 2-9, paragraph 3, your report talks about exterior lighting, if applicable. And in a project that creates this interior courtyard, it pretty well shields that area off from any light illumination that might come from around the site. I'm concerned about safety and security, because when I've been in developments like this before, it can be pretty dark. So I wondered what staff's take on that was, and if you're not concerned, or if you are,
And Ryan Hofstadter, planning staff. The project does include exterior lighting. Just I would like to defer to the project architect to elaborate on that. But the Avila Beach specific plan requires shielding of all external lights, so there isn't a requirement in the plan to have external lights in this case. But when they're there, they are required to be shielded. So as far as in lights within the courtyard, I don't know the placement of all of those, but the architect can elaborate on that.
Okay. Madam Chair, could I add a follow-up to the affordable housing question? Although she's correct about the ordinance not being adopted in the coastal zone, there is a requirement in our coastal plan that if you're providing 11 or more units, you provide affordable housing. And because they're less than that number here, there's no requirement under that section of the ordinance.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I found when I was going through it as well. Under utilities, it refers to underground service and service laterals be stubbed into each lot. In other places, for example, on 218, gas line should be stalled and service lateral stubbed into each unit. And then 19 talks about lots again. If I understood you right, there's one lot, and this should all say units?
That's correct. We can, and I want to make sure that in Public Works is okay with changing that, but to units.
Glenn Marshall, Public Works, we agree with you that it should be changed from lot to units.
Didn't mean to be picky, but I don't know if there was significance or not.
Thank you.
Okay, those are all my questions.
Okay, other questions for staff? With that, we'll open it up to the public. The applicant or the applicant architect is here. Would you like to speak? Good morning. If you will fill out a speaker slip when you get a chance after you speak,
okay,
we'll
sure.
Take that for the record.
Well, good morning. My name is Leonard Grant, and I'm the architect for the project. I'll be fairly brief. And I'd like to do a short presentation and then get to a couple of the issues that were brought up by commissioners. First of all, I'd like to thank Ryan, our staff planner. I think she's done an excellent job through the process and representing the project and bringing us to this point. So I don't want to necessarily talk too much about the units and the design of the physical design. Maybe some more planning aspects of the project, because I thought she did a really good job of outlining it. So, first of all, I'd like to kind of put a label on the project for the purposes of the presentation, and I'd like to call it contextual smart growth, because I know smart growth is a huge topic right now and working on projects throughout the county where this issue is coming up. But I think that each project really needs to take a look at the community in which we're designing in and really take our cues from the neighborhood and from the community as a way of addressing this issue. And so I would request that you all keep that in mind as future projects come forward, that you take into consideration the community and the desire of the community as well as the county's overall goals in smart growth and things like that. And I think we've done that here. Fortunately, I think we've achieved that. Ryan, could you possibly put up slide L1, please? So the objectives of our project were to achieve the highest density possible given the context of our project in the neighborhood and the city, or in the community and the county. Given the context really of several things, one being the architectural character of Avila Beach, the intent of the Avila Beach specific plan, the objectives of smart growth principles within the county, and the economic objectives of our client. So there's our sheet L1 there. Thank you. And so you could see that the, I think this is a really great slide. It really, it kind of demonstrates a lot of those principles. It's a compact urban form. We're being very sensitive to the environment and how we're addressing site access and drainage. And then some of the other slides really speak more to the neighborhood and community context. So if we could go to the slide that's labeled neighborhood context. There we go. Perfect. Thanks. So in the beginning of this, of our process of working on the project, the first thing we like to always do is open our eyes and take a look at the surrounding community which we're designing. Fortunately, we've been involved with, I think, 5 projects downtown in the last couple of years, so some of the slides are past projects of ours, but I think it's critical to look at the character of the area around it. Avila has a rich variety of stone, wood siding, stucco, and metal and concrete accents all in these pictures and throughout the community. The roof is a variety of parapets and sloped roofs, and the colors are a range of pastels and whites, and this is very consistent with the specific plan that was derived many years ago when Avila was redeveloping. Page 5 of the Avila Beach specific plan states that they wanted to preserve the funky and eclectic character of Avila Beach and use a variety of building materials to enhance the streetscape and enliven the district visually, page 73. Page 74, provide a variety of roof shapes and parapets. I think Ryan's presentation really specifically addressed those, how we did that.
Page 93. I didn't put individual floor plans in the PowerPoint because they're too hard to read on the PowerPoint. They're pretty much illegible in there. So on your packets, however, are the floor plans, and it includes the roof decks. So 2-93 is what he's referring to as, I think that's a 1.1 and 2 and 3, so 2-93 in your package.
I can see that deck plan for the roof, but I can't see the continuation of the roof. Is there,
right.
There's an open break, so if you try to crawl over, you drop how far?
Yeah, surrounding each would be, you know, flat roof areas.
Yes.
And other pitched roof areas. So typically, I don't remember specifically if we have any that would fall all the way to the ground, but I don't know if I'm...
Between the units, does the flat roof continue on from
yes.
unit to unit?
So the main
your neighbor
thing
could come over to your spa and...
Well, you know, if they got desperate, surely they could find a way to get over there, but they're designed to be separated. The main difference is more structurally that you have to calculate for a much bigger load and a flat roof than you do for a regular roof, and you don't have the railing. So, anyways, they're designed to have separation and to take into account security. I mean, it'd be obviously very difficult for anybody from the public, but if a neighbor really was desperate, they could find their way over there. But they're designed to be separated.
And then another question while we're on the roof here is, I see this, it looks like a sink and a dishwasher on the roof. Is that what's proposed?
I think we're proposing.
I see a spa, and it looks like a sink and a dishwasher on each roof also.
Isn't dishwashers too? No, just a sink and a hot tub.
2-93. It's on multiple pages, but I'm looking at 2-93. It's got the symbol for a dishwasher. If you look at the kitchen and the other floor plan, same symbol.
Yeah. You know, really we're proposing the spa and the sink, and then, you know, it looks like a...
I'm sorry?
Like a little refrigerator under counter.
Okay, so it's not a dishwasher. It's
right, not
a reefer. That triggers another question in my mind. Maybe I'm over scrutinizing the project. Maybe this is more for building, but is there a concern with stormwater intrusion into that open air sink, or will there be a cover over that sink? Or
yeah, we haven't gotten to that level of detail.
That, I don't know if that's something we would want to address here, but you know, with an open sink, you know, you're going to have stormwater intrusion into
right.
the sewer system. So.
Well, I mean, we could always condition that to have a cover over it. We do that in, a lot in Shell Beach, where we always pretty much provide roof decks on any of the inland pieces, so that's
that might be something we want to look at here a little later then.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
Go ahead.
No problem. I was just trying to answer some of the questions that were brought up. We did find Ryan's calculation for parking to be consistent. We're on board with that.
You want to just run through that? We didn't run through that. Do you have calcs on you, or Ms. Hostetter did?
I think the discrepancy is in the guest parking and the way we, when we added up just the parking for the individual units, we concluded that we needed 10 spaces for the individual units. And then when we did the guest parking, we did one plus one for every four units. So that's why we came to three.
But the staff report says one for the next four, not the first original four. That's where what confused me.
Right.
But in fact, is it, just from my own knowledge, in fact, is it for all four, or is it, is the first guest parking intended for the first four?
The first guest spot is intended for the first four.
So it should really be 12, but right. 13 are being applied here, so we're we're better than what's required.
Right.
That was my interpretation, so thank you.
Yeah, for what it's worth, the way I always read it was one plus one for every next four. So you'd have one plus, since there's eight,
right.
8 divided by 4 would be 2, so 13. But if that's changing, then we're overparked, and we would maybe reuse that for something else or get credit for 20.
No, I think, I think that's the way it is written, 1 plus, and then the division. So I think 13 is actually the requirement.
Well, I mean, I don't want to belabor the point, but that's not the way it's written, no.
It'd be good if, to get clarification for future projects if that was indeed more strictly applied than was intended. Let me see. It's hard for me to speak to the Quimby fee issue, but if there is a possibility of getting credit, we'd like to, you know, come back in and request that if it's not too late. So it'd be nice to get interpretation from you if we could come back and request the credit. I'm sure a client would want to if possible.
Maybe then, we can discuss that then, or the council can elaborate on procedure for that after.
Well, I think you'd have to start all over.
Be asking for a continuance, no matter what, on that issue. Unless something else happens. But and then, Commissioner.
We had a little more than on, it sounds like we need to wrap this up. We had a few more questions on lighting plans and on sidewalks, I believe. Oh, no, maybe sidewalks were answered, that was a concrete sidewalk, Mr. Marshall answered. So lighting, as I heard it then.
In regards to lighting, you know, we applied lighting to the building, but we didn't get into specific lighting for the open space, but we'd be happy to hear a condition to make sure that was adequately lighted for security. I think you're right on board on there. We don't get into every detail sometimes, but that's the great thing about having you guys as part of the team here.
I appreciate your comments on, on that.
And
bring that back.
I believe that that's pretty much it. I would request your approval of this project so we can move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the applicant before he steps down further? Okay, with that, I'll open it up to the public. Anyone here from the public wishing to speak on this item? Seeing no one, we'll close public comment and bring it back to the commission. And so let's start then, having heard the discussion on the credits then for the Quimby fees. Commissioner White, do you want to follow up on that?
Well, my point that I'm trying to make is that I fear maybe this is the law, maybe this is open to interpretation, but it seems inequitable to me that a vacant piece of land would require the same Quimby fees as an existing impacted land. And what we have here is three current impacts. So if you have two side-by-side parcels, this one and a vacant land next to it, it seems, again, an unfair burden to the existing impact property to have the same fees as a vacant land property, because there are, in fact, three existing impacts on this side.
And with that's the only three point structures, are these structures three residential units currently? They are. Okay.
And that's the only point I was trying to make. You know, if it were me applying, I'd be really pursuing that issue.
Understood. I think it's a valid sort of topic for discussion. Council has some comments?
Yeah, the point I wanted to make is the code provides for Quimby fees not applying if there's a conversion of an existing apartment building that's more than 5 years old and no new dwellings are added, and I don't think this fits within that definition. So I think this law itself provides that they're not entitled to have the fees not be applicable.
Because we're not converting dwellings here. We're actually demolishing and rebuilding.
If you remember, we had a project up in San Miguel last year where there was a conversion of existing apartment buildings into planned development that Elizabeth Cavanaugh brought before the commission. And that project had existing apartments that were just being converted to planned development in that case. And because of that, they did not have to pay the fee. But I don't think that's the situation you have here, and I don't think it would come within the language of the code.
Just to follow up, Mr. Orton, I agree with that interpretation under that circumstance, but I guess I'm going beyond that. Obviously, this doesn't apply to the circumstance and the credit that you just described, but I would just think that there should be, if there's not, there probably should be a credit for existing impact fees. They are, in fact, impact fees. And just on its face value and its practical common sense rationale of it, in my mind anyway, there's three existing impacts and we're adding five more. We're not really adding eight new impacts. So there may not be provisions in the law for it, but I just wanted to bring that up in case there was a way to pursue that.
Okay, so the follow-up question to that is, the law doesn't mandate a credit for the three existing units, but would it allow for a credit if so chosen? It doesn't dictate that a credit couldn't be given, or
it allows for a credit for active recreation, which is a separate issue that we discussed. I think that as far as allowing, I think either the Quimby Act applies or it doesn't apply, and the way the law is written right now, I think it does apply to this project and the fees are required. I think the state legislature is where you'd have to go to change that section of the law to broaden that.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Commissioner?
Well, if I understand Commissioner White, that I guess the implication is by charging those fees on already impacted areas that the county's double or triple dipping. Is that not fair, right?
I suppose that's one way to put it.
One way to look at it. Okay.
There's currently property taxes paid on those existing units.
I wish there was a way to, I agree with the interpretation that council has presented.
I do too. Yes.
As we go with some possible language on the lighting. And clarification as we start here, are we talking about the interior courtyard lighting, or are we talking about exterior lighting?
Well, I'm talking about interior courtyard, exterior lighting.
Okay, so just the courtyard, not out onto the sidewalk
that's correct.
Other area. Okay,
no, that,
thank you.
That's correct. Okay. And I think on page 2-9, where the county's language talks about providing details about height and location and intensity and shielded lamps, I just would like language in the condition that prohibits building-mounted light fixtures. And preferring instead village-style pole-mounted fixtures where the lamp is recessed up inside and the light goes down, because when you put a side-mounted fixture, try as you might to shield it, you just can't get the job done other than just right under the fixture. If you blast it out from the side, you're going to be impacting the residents on the other side of the courtyard with glare. So,
could I elaborate? Yeah, there's obviously many different ways to get a light in that area, but like a bollard, for example, would be another, as long as it's, and it sounds like what we're interested in is the safety aspects of the open yard areas as well as in the parking lot area underneath the building to make sure it's adequately lighted to see, as well as safety to see if there's anybody out there, right?
Yes,
and
correct.
Sure, it have to be motion sensored and things like that.
Photocell, the typical light at time, photocell lighting controls.
Yeah.
Yes, automatic, not switched on and off by building residents who may not do it.
Yeah.
So the concern is that there be some lighting and that it be shooting downward rather than outward.
Yes.
Dual concerns there?
Yes, that's correct.
Jeff has some language. on that, Ms. Hostetter?
On page 2-9, condition number 3, the specific plan requires that lighting be shielded already, and that's reflected in condition number 3, so we were thinking of adding a sentence onto the end of condition 3, basically saying that the project shall include safety lighting within the courtyard. So it requires there to be safety lighting, but that safety lighting has to comply with shielding so that the neighbors are not affected.
That's fine. I just wanted to sensitize the county to my experience with building-mounted lighting that it does create glare problems almost unavoidably. So, but I'm satisfied with your language.
Okay, so there's a second part, though, that you're not completely satisfied with. I mean, it sounds like there are two issues. So this is requiring lighting, but I'm hearing an issue with building-mounted side lighting.
Well, there's two things. The objective is safety and security, and then this part two is the method by which you do that. And I was just wanting to proscribe building-mounted fixtures in favor of, as Mr. Grant suggested, ground-mounted either pole or bollard lighting. I'd be most comfortable with that language.
To add in the applicant some kind of non-building mounted.
That's correct.
Lighting.
For the courtyard, for the open space areas. And then did you want to go to this extent of the driveways underneath the building? Because we haven't designed that, and it seemed like it would be.
Or you
leave that up to us to make sure?
I'm comfortable leaving that up to you, because if there's no windows or objectionable recipient of glare on the other side is to worry about the fixture, that's not an issue then.
Okay.
So I just didn't want to tie your hands to that extent.
And that's fine with me, as long as it's left really general like that. We're agreeable to that.
We can always add a sentence to the end of number 3, which says, the project shall include safety lighting within the courtyard, which shall be affixed to the building.
But I think that's
shall
the aggressive
not,
way.
Shall not.
You don't want
I,
to.
No, I,
okay.
I...
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the confusion. Do you want to just signal, and you're afraid that's, you've called that mounting, side mounting, that's...
Wall pack lighting is just going to create a glare. And I don't want to allow wall pack lighting except where the parking is and there's no... recipient of the glare because you have a blank wall on the other side.
I think it's an important point in any of these design features that we can incorporate, you know, with the agreement of the applicant to make these tight, you know, urban spaces more comfortable are important points. So I think it's worth a little time to try to incorporate it in here when there's not necessarily extra cost or expense, that we can make these spaces more comfortable for the people who are going to live in them.
I think, yes. I think light pollution is becoming more and more of an issue, and I'm just trying to make suggestions of approaches. I know at the meeting 2 weeks ago, there were light pollution. I had
looking kind of to the public outdoor area, but currently we've got these shielded lights on our little private decks, and I don't know if you wanted to even... If that was okay, we would hope that would be okay if it was low level and not shining out into the street, but it does speak to your comment, too. I don't know if you were going to address the private deck areas.
Well, to me, the issue there is the same as it's on the roof. I don't want private areas to inflict pollution on beyond that space. And so if there's a way to... condition that language, if you could suggest some language.
That's a harder one because it's hard to put bollards or pole mounts on private decks. It's very simple in terms of a public outdoor space, but you know, we could do low level lighting on the deck so that, you know, you could at least see where you're walking and getting it out of the unit and keep it as low level as possible. That would be good, but to put pole mounts on the decks would be impractical.
Then perhaps language that says private decks and roof lighting shall be accomplished with low height level light fixtures.
And
does that work for you?
You could take it all the way to the entrance of the building. That almost needs to be a little bit higher so that people can see where the door is and they're secure.
You know, you're hitting on my thoughts as Mr. Commissioner O'Grady's outlining this. I think if I understand correctly, he's not concerned about, you know, front door wall-mounted lighting as long as it's down, shielded down and non-reflective. I think what is concerned is that you don't utilize that type of lighting to light the parking area.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I just didn't want to get us stuck into a position where we actually...
No, but up on a raised deck, you may get glare because you're seeing up underneath the shielding, so mm-hmm. that may change the situation.
So you're on the ground, you're looking up.
Exactly, but when you're on ground level and you have one next to a door that's typical,
perfect.
I don't think that's an issue.
Okay, right. Thank you.
If I understand, yeah, okay.
So does staff have a few additions then to language to... try to incorporate some of these intents. We have, I think we're all okay with the suggestion, shall include safety lighting within the courtyard, but I think it would be more helpful to try to carry that on a little, that intent of avoiding the side-mounted or pole-mounted lighting, to try to eliminate some of the glare potential.
Again, Madam Chair, what I think I'm hearing is the pole mounting is what's being requested in the parking area because it will just downlight the parking area.
Right. So we're in the courtyard.
Yes, we just don't want to rely on the house lighting or the building lighting, exterior building lighting, for access to the units to light the parking area.
Sure, it's very simple. You could just say courtyard lighting shall be accomplished with pole-mounted fixtures.
And then we want to address the deck that's low and the roof with low-level lighting, soft lighting that doesn't light the night sky.
Right, and again, standards already require shielding, so that's already there. So what are we doing beyond that?
Well, I think as Commissioner White just said, where we're talking about the roof, and we're talking about, let's just take the roof. It shall be, the lighting on the roof shall be accomplished with low mounting height fixtures that are not visible from the ground. Does that make sense to everybody?
Sure. I think the applicant's nodding. I think that meets the intent.
I
think the design accommodates that quite well with the parapets around the roof area to light it that way.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it. It looks like, I don't know if it's a wrought iron or a spiral staircase going up, and I assume you'd have to do some low-level lighting going up and down that also. But obviously, by the way, I'd like to compliment you on your design. It looks like it will be a really nice project, so obviously you understand our intent here.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yes. Then the one issue I brought up with the stormwater intrusion into the open-air sinks, I don't know if there's some sort of condition language on that we want to put in. And Mr. Orton brought up about the condominium association requirements. Madam Chair, I think we're beyond our break. Would it now be a good time to take a break and let staff try to work on the commission?
That may be a good suggestion then, that staff could take the break to get the wording so we can read that into the record. For these four items, we're looking at possible conditional wording for the open air sink, the lighting wording, make sure we have the new condition 25 regarding the homeowners association and the changes from lots to units. So let's take a 15-minute break. We'll come back at 10:45 and finish up on this item too. We'll call this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo Planning Commission back to order. And if staff will read in language, we're looking at a couple of changes and additions to the conditions. So we had a few language changes.
In all access and parking areas is the word language that I suggested.
So 25C, common area including all access and parking areas. Okay, everyone comfortable with that? Changes to 25 for homeowners. Okay, we had a second change then. Somewhere in there we were changing lots to units.
Yes.
Staff will read in those changes.
I did them in order, so...
Okay.
Let's see. The first change that we made actually deals with the sink covers, if the commission wants to add that language. We added it to condition number 2, which basically requires that when the applicant submits their construction documents for planning division review We'll ensure that on the construction documents, there's a note on there that the outdoor sink areas are covered. So we added on condition number 2, plans shall include covers for all outdoor sink areas.
Okay, commissioners comfortable with that language? Drainage?
If I were the applicant, I think I'd object to the word areas. I think the objective here is just not to let the stormwater into the sewer, so if you can just cover the sink. In other words, sinks, all outdoor sinks.
Oh, sinks.
Period.
That's a good point. I agree with that.
Clarify. Intent. Okay.
Okay. So then we also amended condition 3 for you to review. We've added a sentence at the end, two sentences actually. Project shall include pole-mounted safety lighting within the courtyard, which shall be shielded. Low-level fixtures shall be used on all deck and roof areas.
Okay, Commissioner O'Grady, that meets your intent.
Could we just do on low-level, say low-height level, so it's clearer we're talking about the height of the fixture and not the wattage of the fixture?
Sure.
And that provides us flexibility then for the entryway and parking where some higher level lighting may be appropriate?
There are building code requirements actually for specific lighting on entrances and exits, which we don't review at this stage of the game. So
okay.
This won't preclude that.
Okay. And the applicant's comfortable with that or some comments on that?
I just didn't want to preclude the baller lighting or other types. I think pole is one way of doing it, but I think the intent was to not have wall-mounted, but there are several different ways to get the, you know, safety lighting levels.
So maybe should we say non-wall-mounted? Is that a clearer way of eliminating that and meeting your intent there? That would allow for bollard or pole or...
You could say pole or bollard or the like.
Yeah, pole or bollard. I prefer that. It's more direct and it says exactly what we want.
Okay. Okay. Commissioner, comfortable with that wording on lighting then? Okay.
We, let me continue on then to our next change. It's in Exhibit D. We saw a typo underneath number 5. We want to remove the word drainage. That shouldn't be there. That's just a typo. And we changed lot to unit in a few places. So condition number 6F, utilities to serve every lot, or unit, I'm sorry, instead of lot. We made similar changes to number 16, change lot to unit, and number 19. And then the next change is number 25, which we went over already. And that was all.
About the Homeowners Association. Okay. Any other changes or discussion on this item? I also just want to thank the applicant for willingness to work with us here in bringing us a nice-looking, dense project in Avila that meets our intent of policies here.
I really apologize. Could I make one more clarification?
Sure, if there's something unclear.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a big deal or not, but we were talking about serving power, utilities, et cetera, to the units, but normally in these types of projects, it comes into a bank of meters, I'm not sure if that's going to meet the intent of the economic viability of the project if we're serving, we're typically going to go to a bank of meters and then from there it goes to the units. So, unfortunately I'm not a contractor, I just know in our other projects like this that we're not serving all the utilities directly to the units. We're typically going to meter locations and then from there distributing to the units. So it's a little bit different in these condominium type projects.
I think the intent is just that they're undergrounded, so maybe we can give the flexibility and just maintain the undergrounding.
Thank you.
What specific condition are we looking at for that one?
Well, for example, 16 on utilities.
Power unit is applicable. We may as well be consistent then.
Because I think the gas on each side, they'll have a group of meters on each side, so they'll probably stub in more than one place on the lot.
Okay. Okay. And was there one more condition that we had changed to lot or unit prior to that?
Number 19.
Just that one on numbering.
You know, while we're on this, another thing just popped in my mind. Because these are contiguous units, they're not separated. There's fire sprinkling required in these. I started thinking about easements for gas lines, and I recall in Templeton we had a project that had easements for the fire sprinkler system.
I believe they are. They have received a fire plan review already for this project, but I can't remember if it included fire sprinklers.
Maybe the applicant can step up and address that. I don't know if we need some sort of conditioning on fire sprinkler requirement.
It'll be sprinklered. There's so many different systems that I don't remember exactly which system it is, but there'll be. Typically, we don't have easements for fire sprinklers. It's just that sprinklers go through the units, but it'll be sprinklered.
They will be sprinkled.
Yeah, definitely. Any buildings over 1,000 feet in the county.
You envision easements for utilities and fire sprinklers, or will each condo unit be serviced on its own unit?
Yeah.
So gas, power, water, fire sprinklers?
Yeah, I haven't gotten into the specifics on how that, but I assume each one's metered separately since they're individual properties, essentially.
The issue isn't if they're metered separately. We assume that that will be the case. The issue is where they're serviced, if they're going to come in that down the end of the building, easements through the attic to each unit, or will they come in on each individual unit?
Yeah, there'd be bank of meters, depending on which utility.
In the common area.
They're fed into the units itself without any specific easements within the project.
So you could bank them in the common area, then service them to each individual unit.
Yeah.
So no, but do we need anything on fire sprinkling requirements?
No, we actually already have a condition that requires the project comply with fire code requirements, and that's condition number 5 on Exhibit B.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions or discussion? Do I hear a motion then on this project?
Okay, I'll give this a shot. My first motion. I assume I read from the recommended action portion.
That's right.
Thank you. I move to adopt the mitigated negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 21000, and Latin, et cetera, I suppose. Also move to approve the vesting tentative tract 3010 and development plan coastal development permit based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and Exhibit C and the conditions listed in Exhibit B and Exhibit D as amended, as noted previously.
I'll second that.
Okay. With that, if the clerk will call the vote.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Milskow?
Yes.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. We'll move on to item 3.
Item 3 is commission business, a scoping session for environmental issues connected with the land use and circulation elements area update rural area. County file number LRP 2008-00002, all supervisorial districts. Mike Wolfkin, project manager.
Thank you. Chairman Wyatt, good morning, commissioners. Chuck Stevenson, planning staff. I have a few introductory comments before I turn it over to Mike Wolfkin and Jeff Oliveira. This morning, we're introducing to your commission and to the public the land use element and circulation plan update for the rural areas of the county. The second purpose of that is to also have a scoping session for the environmental impact report that will be prepared for this update. The land use element and the circulation element are two of the 7 mandated elements to the general plan. And you may have heard of this previously as a rural area plan update, and we've since changed the name to clarify it a bit to it is the land use element for just the rural areas of the county. The urban areas and the village areas that are also part of the land use element will be dealt with separately at a later time. We're just looking at the rural areas of the county. There will be an environmental impact report prepared for this. And a scoping session is part of today's hearing, as I mentioned, and that's a term that in CEQA parlance refers to a opportunity for the public to learn about the EIR, the issues that staff has identified, whereby the county was divided into 15 areas, roughly arbitrary, but the intent was to look at those and update them over a period of a few years, just update data, make fine adjustments, and continue to keep that as a sort of a live document. But that approach has not worked as it was anticipated, and out of the 15 area plans, we've only been able to update about four or five, I believe. I think five of them. And they've taken a long period of time, and they've cost more than we had anticipated. So the result is that we have inconsistencies with language between some of the planning areas. We have some standards that are slightly different than the others, some that are omitted altogether. And so our plan was to, how can we streamline this, make it more cost-effective for taxpayers in terms of the, keeping the cost down? And that was to come up with one rural area plan, recognizing that there are important sub-areas in the county, but those would be chapters in this document. So consolidation was a big part of this effort. The second goal was to implement strategic growth principles that the Board of Supervisors has recently adopted into the general plan. And those will deal with the mandates for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, try to address reducing vehicle miles traveled, looking at linking land use and transportation together with the SB 375, the Sustainable Community Strategy, and then looking also at how we can plan, a third item is how we can plan for growth based on sustainable resources. So in that vein, we want to look at our watersheds and what policies can we put in place to protect those watersheds and sustain our growth based on those. We also wanted to identify the least constrained areas for possible future growth around or adjacent to our existing community. We know that whenever we talk about expanding our urban communities, we're going to be bumping into the problem of agricultural land conversion. And so part of this exercise is to help us identify the least constrained areas that might be appropriate for growth when those community plans become updated. And then a last point would be that we want to engage in collaboration with the cities at an unprecedented level. In other words, we're in this together from a regional standpoint, and in accordance with the principles for SB 375, which calls for regional cooperation, we need to work more closely than ever with our cities to understand how we're going to accommodate growth in a sustainable fashion. We can't work in isolated manner any longer. So we've already begun that process. We have met with each of the supervisors, the county supervisors, and myself have met with city managers and the mayors and the planning managers for each of the cities to talk about this program already. And we want to continue that. So that's an overview I hope is helpful to sort of guide what the intent was of this, what the purpose is. One major thing I'll leave you with, and that is that this is not envisioned as rezoning a lot of property in the county. Most of which is zoned agriculture will stay agriculture, rural lands, and so forth. What we will be trying to look at is possible ways to help reduce the rate of rural area growth a bit. We know that there's been a considerable amount of rural growth in the last 10 years, and we're looking for ways that may slow that rate down a bit. But aside from that, there are no major rezonings being envisioned by this update. So with those general comments, I'd like to introduce Mike Wilkin, who is a supervising planner for community planning section in our department, and Jeff Oliveira, who is an environmental specialist, and he is the manager for the Managing the Environmental Impact Report, and they'll go into more detail.
Thank you, Chuck, for that rather complete overview. I'll try not to repeat too much of what Chuck has said in my presentation, but I did first want to start out by telling you what we intend to accomplish here today with the scoping meeting. The intent of the scoping meeting is really to introduce the project to your commission and the public and the possible environmental considerations at an early time in the process of our update to encourage the public to participate to the greatest degree possible. But what we don't want to do today is get into a discussion of the pros and cons or the merits of the actual land use and circulation element update. We're really here to discuss the environmental issues and issue areas. Why would we like to hold this scoping session now, early in the process? Well, first of all, we want to discover what the talking more about the land use and circulation element project. The concept is to consolidate and revise the land use and circulation elements for the rural areas of the county, the rural unincorporated areas, taking a regional approach to growth and resources, an approach that we really haven't been able to effectively take before because we've been updating our planning areas piecemeal, planning area by planning area, without taking a big picture look at the county. We'd like to follow and implement the strategic growth policies that the board has adopted and the strategies, the conservation and open space element policies and strategies that are about to be adopted by the Board of Supervisors, and the housing element policies that have just been adopted by the board. And as Chuck mentioned, we like to consolidate planning areas and area plans. We haven't set the number of planning areas yet or their boundaries, but the idea is to take the 15 planning areas and make fewer ones. This isn't just another regular update that we're embarking on here, so we're not taking a routine approach. There are opportunities to be innovative in this project, and so a regional approach to strategic growth is one of them. Planning for growth based on sustainable resources is another, and then comprehensively addressing things like climate change and greenhouse gases and vehicle miles traveled, which are emerging issues that the state is requiring that we look at. And in fact, the climate action plan portions, relevant portions of the climate action plan, are to be incorporated into this land use and circulation element update. And also, we'll be looking at watershed planning. In fact, the planning area boundaries that we are looking at revising are going to be based on watershed boundaries and groundwater basins. And Chuck mentioned that we're going to be doing an unprecedented effort at reaching out to cities and special districts and other agencies as part of this update. And we've already started that. I just wanted to give you some background on the situation that we're facing to kind of set the stage for the what we're going to be doing in the update. There are many challenges that face the county: water, infrastructure, increasing rural development and the impacts of rural growth, increasing traffic volumes, and the need to assure a vital economy at the same time. This is what's been happening as far as population and housing growth. Actually, this is what could happen with population and housing growth in the future. Projections from 2008 to 2030 show that in the unincorporated areas alone, there could be an additional 26,000 people by the year 2030, which translates into a need for about 10,800 dwelling units. And in the rural areas, if past trends continue, that would mean about 4,300 additional dwelling units in just the unincorporated rural areas. So the question is, where are those going to go? And between 2000 and 2007, we've seen that about 40% of our building permits in the unincorporated areas have gone into the rural areas, and we think that's too high. This shows a distribution of those building permits in the unincorporated areas between the years 2000 and 2007, and you can see it's quite dispersed, although there are some rural areas that have been receiving more growth than others. So where will this growth go? Staff believes that the percentage of growth occurring in the rural areas needs to be reduced, and there are a number of concerns of continued rural growth at this rate. For example, we have the our community plans and our communities, such as the urban areas and the village areas, growing and reaching or nearing their capacities, their build-out capacities. This chart shows that in the future, most of those communities will be at or near their build-out capacities, which just puts pressure for more growth outside those communities. Also, if past trends continue, we'll see a majority of future growth occurring in areas that have limited groundwater resources. And this chart shows the El Pomar, Estrella areas and the South County areas as areas of particular concern in that regard. And this illustrates some of the additional problems or concerns with increasing rural development. This uses the El Pomar area non-conforming subdivisions or antiquated subdivisions as an example. So some of the major themes that we are going to deal with in this update are sustainable resources and providing or planning for providing infrastructure that's needed if we are to have growth where we want it to be. Maintaining a vital economy, protecting rural character, and preserving habitat, biological resources, and then collaborating with the other agencies. And some of the key topics are the land and resources that are needed for future growth, planning for those, locating potential growth areas, and dealing with areas on the edges of communities or between communities, for example, these community separators between communities which have been identified already in the county general plan. And this is just a diagram that is intended to illustrate the idea or concept of showing least constrained areas for a potential community expansion. That will be one of the things that we hope to accomplish as part of this update, is to identify through a very extensive environmental constraints mapping, and considering other constraints as well, like public services and infrastructure, identify those areas that are least constrained and could be areas for potential community expansion. Now, those areas will be identified on a more conceptual level. We won't be rezoning such areas at this time. And the actual planning and rezoning of those areas would occur at a later time, either through an update of the community plan or through an application maybe for a specific plan for such an area. So at this time, we'll just be identifying conceptually where those areas might be. And it's not necessarily true that every community or village will have one of these. It's really going to depend upon the actual constraints. So there may be a few of these areas identified. There may be more. We don't know at this time. It's going to be dictated by the actual constraints. And again, some of the additional key topics have to do with rural development policies to try to limit inappropriate rural growth and protect agricultural resources and rural character, and to try to focus development where it's most appropriate, where there's services and infrastructure. And we have heard some concerns about this idea of consolidating planning areas, which would make some of the planning areas bigger than they are now. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about that. When we were at the board last year, we heard some concerns from the public about this, so I wanted to address those. First of all, why do we want to consolidate planning areas? Well, Chuck pointed out that there would be a cost savings when we go to update the general plan in the future. We want to avoid piecemeal updating of the general plan by area plan, or planning area by planning area. We need to take a regional approach and look at the big picture, rather than individual planning area by planning area. And that's really needed to deal with the issues that are upon us now as far as growth and housing, vehicle miles traveled, reducing that, reducing greenhouse gases and so forth. And also, the revising the planning area boundaries gives us an opportunity to look at them on a watershed basis and follow watershed boundaries. There were some concerns expressed that if we combine planning areas or consolidate them, make some of them larger, that we wouldn't be able to address certain areas that communities or people are concerned about, specific areas or neighborhoods. Well, that's not really the case. We're still going to be able, through this plan, to identify areas that are of special interest, areas of special resources, for example, the El Pomar area or the Napomo Mesa water management area, groundwater management area, areas of community separators or least constrained areas around communities. We'll still be able to identify and deal with those in the update. Also, we're going to retain the planning area standards that are a key part of the current area plans, and those planning area standards can deal specifically with sites, with neighborhoods, with subdivisions, or with larger areas as needed. So those will be retained. And this is a similar to a map we showed the board last year, and it shows possible sub-regional planning areas. This map happens to show three inland and two coastal, but the actual boundaries and numbers haven't really been determined, land use categories and combining designations. So there's a little bit of a reorganization of our land use element. And so what we expect to accomplish is to comprehensively address resources and growth, to simplify the land use element. I think Chuck pointed out that this simplification will reduce a lot of the redundancies that are and inconsistencies that occur now among the different area plans, and this will also save money in the long run. And some of the benefits will include being able to live within our resources, reducing impacts to rural areas and agriculture, improving air quality, reducing commuting, saving energy, perhaps less costly public services, and setting the stage for having more housing opportunities for the workforce and having jobs better related to housing. So the schedule is to begin an extensive public outreach program very soon, to release a public review draft of the update at the end of this year, and a public hearing draft in the middle of next year, and to start planning commission hearings at the end of the fall of next year, 2011. And adoption is tentatively scheduled for August of 2012. So this is a long process, and we're just starting it now. But we wanted to bring everybody in at an early stage because it's complicated and it's involved and it's important. So we wanted to bring everybody in at the earliest stage possible. And at this time, with that background, I wanted to turn it over to Jeff Oliveira, who's going to talk about the environmental issues and more about the scoping meeting. But hopefully that overview was helpful for the public and for your commission to understand what we're doing. So, Jeff?
To plan out our lives here. we're not planners, are we? No. Let's ask, maybe before Mr. Oliveira takes over, we could ask questions. Sounds like there are at least a few for Mr. Wolken. So if they're relevant to what Mr. Oliveira has already prepared, we'll stop them and hear the presentation. But Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes, good morning. Some of the charts you put up showed forecasts from 2008 to, what was it, 2030. And yet, in 2008, that was kind of a unusual year, shall we say, for our economy. And I just wondered how have you assessed or will you be assessing the impact on your forecast by changes in our economy?
Yes. We've actually revised our forecasts and worked with the Council of Governments so that our forecast is consistent with the forecast that was just adopted by the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. And so we'll be looking at a horizon year actually of 2035 for this update, and that matches with the horizon year in the SLOCOG population estimates. So we're consistent, and when SLOCOG looked at their population forecasts, they considered three different scenarios, I believe, and they settled on one, taking into account the recent economic conditions. So that has been taken into account.
Okay, just one other question. You showed a constraints map, looked like four or five amoebas on there, and I wondered if there was going to be some quantitative analysis, some numbers would be assigned to desirability of development in different areas and a score established, so there would be more of a objective mathematical way to, for people to see how decisions are made.
Yes, I was trying to find that diagram here. It seemed to have disappeared. And yes, it was just a diagram with a number of blobs, and that was just intended to be to illustrate the concept of looking at different kinds of constraints, for example, flood hazard areas and areas of geological concern or archaeological concern, biological resource, and so forth, and then trying to identify areas that have the most constraints, and then by virtue of that, the areas that would be least constrained for development. But the answer to your question is yes, we will be taking kind of a scientific approach, if you will. We will be trying to assign weights, actually, to the different resources, both. And yet we want to plan for appropriate areas for potential community expansion. And it's possible there may be some conflicts there. So that's one of the things we'll have to look at pretty carefully. We want to try to do both.
Right.
But there may have to be some give and take there when it comes down to finding areas for appropriate expansion.
And then rezoning was mentioned, and I know in our staff report that was presented to us, there were some time frames for property owners to submit to be rezoned. So the rezoning will in fact be part of this or not?
We'll be considering property owner requests, and maybe I should give you a little bit of background on that. The reason we do that is because the general plan requires it. Whenever you update the general plan, people that submit requests for rezoning typically have to have those requests considered as part of the update, because you generally don't want those going their own track. You want them to be considered as part of the updating of the plan. So that's why we have this thing called property owner requests, and people will have an opportunity if they want to submit zoning changes to submit their applications, have them considered with this plan. Generally, there are exceptions. And then there's the window actually for property owner requests just opened, and it will go up until, according to the general plan, 45 days before the draft of the plan is released. So that looks like it's going to be towards the end of the year, probably November or so, when the window will close.
So what I'm hearing is this is, by process, this is an opportunity to request rezoning, but staff isn't looking to go out and try to rezone the areas to accommodate this.
Right. Chuck mentioned they're really, the zoning will remain largely the same. There probably will be some targeted changes as part of the update, nothing extensive.
As it evolves to where the appropriate areas are and so forth.
Actually those least constrained areas that we've been talking about won't be rezoned as part of this update. They'll be identified.
Yes.
Rezoning and planning those areas will occur later. But there could be some targeted changes in some areas, targeted zoning changes. But for the most part, zoning is going to remain largely the same. We will have to consider the property owner requests, but they're going to be evaluated against the strategic growth policies and the existing policies in the general plan, and against the policies that we'll be developing as part of this update. So just because somebody submits one doesn't mean that it's going to automatically be approved. They're going to be scrutinized very carefully.
And even though there may not be rezoning per se, is there a consideration of altering the allowances in current zoning? The one that pops to my mind is, you know, the two primary residences out in the rural areas. Will that be on, you know, that currently folks enjoy that entitlement to be able to build two primary residences. Will that be something that's being considered to be repealed, or would that just be on any newly created parcels, existing parcels, or are they comfortable in assuming they'll be able to maintain that current?
Well, it's not something we've really thought about, and I don't think there's any plan at this point to get rid of the ability to do second dwelling units. In fact, that's it's one way to provide more affordable housing, but I suppose technically it's on the table as well as, you know, all sorts of other changes to the plan and ordinances.
Well, I think this is all founded in good ideas and something, as you spelled out, needs to be done, and especially because we need to maximize our resources and but I can see some real pushback if we start going after I don't know if entitlement's the right word, but zoning allowances that people currently enjoy. And things like that could potentially throw a monkey wrench in the whole deal. That would be my concern. And then this may go more to the EIR scoping, but we talked about analysis of vehicle miles traveled currently. Is that weighed against residences versus tourism? Because tourism, as we all know, is a highly sought after, a large part of our economy. And, you know, we have a lot of vehicle miles traveled related to tourism. So will the EIR be trying to separate that out?
Yes, we will. In fact, this issue has come up in a number of venues already. The Council of Governments is dealing with this issue as it does its sustainable community strategy. This is going to be an issue that's addressed in the Climate Action Plan, and both of those, we're going to be coordinating with both of those efforts as we do our update. So the answer is yes, we'll be specifically looking at that, and I believe as part of those other efforts that I mentioned, the tourist traffic or pass-through traffic is going to try to be separated out.
Okay, good. And last question is, recently we had the San Miguel Ranch application, and I know the Army, this is a long process, and I can certainly understand the necessity for it, but, you know, while that offer's on the table,
right,
you know, kind of strike while the iron's hot, I was hoping we could take advantage of
that
offer.
It may be something that the board may want to consider starting before this is completed, for those reasons, that might be a reason to move ahead with that. As far as our planning staff workload, we really don't have the staffing to manage all those projects at one time, so that would be a difficulty.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Other questions at this point?
Yes, I have one concerning the community plans in the county. Will that follow this, or all at one time, or how will that work?
Yeah, the community plans will be updated following the update of the land use and circulation element for the rural areas, and they'll be updated sequentially, but hopefully can go much faster than updates before. Also, there may be some community plans that just need some very strategic changes without really comprehensively revamping the whole plan like we've tried to do in the past. So I think that will probably be our approach, where we can, is to go in and strategically update community plans where needed so that they are consistent with the ideas of strategic growth.
How will we do this one now, and then you go to the community plans, and maybe where they two come together at the urban reserve line, there's some conflicts between this plan that's adopted here and the community plan. How is that resolved?
Well, the idea would be that the community plans would help implement the rural or the land use and circulation element update. For example, when it comes to these least constrained areas that we've been talking about around communities, if there's a community that's affected and we're updating that community plan, then that would be the opportunity to integrate that area and bring it into the urban area for that community and plan the land uses so that they logically connect with that community. So that would be an opportunity to actually implement the land use and circulation element update.
But what if maybe the decided that the community, what the community wants should override what was done here? Is this a chance to amend this plan or what?
Well, that's always a possibility, but what we intend to do is bring the communities, involve the communities and the public in this effort so that we can reach a consensus on where areas for growth are. And it's going to be done looking at the whole county. So instead of looking planning area by planning area, I think that the people are going to be able to see that the burden needs to be shared, if you will, among many different communities, and you kind of lose that when you do one community plan or one area plan update at a time. You simply wind up focusing on that area without looking at the big picture. When we're looking at the whole county and all the communities, I think people will be able to see that there are areas where growth has to occur.
Okay, so what you're saying then is the communities better be involved in this plan because not get surprises down the road when we look at the community plan.
Definitely.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And maybe with Mr. Wilkin following up on that question, you could elaborate a little bit on your plan to involve the communities and seek input. And we've heard some criticism that already, you know, that this is too fast, too much. But we see the plan going over a couple of years, so it's maybe not fast by some standards. Just a little more elaboration then on your rough plan for culling out that community input.
Sure, yeah. I guess we could be criticized for going too fast or going too slow. It is 2.5 years from now, and that's a pretty long process. We've already been working on this for a little while doing background work and technical studies. We already are reaching out to the community advisory councils. In fact, our liaisons will be going out and making some announcements and brief presentations at the advisory council meetings. We have a lot of information on our website already. But aside from that, we're going to be hiring a specialist to help us with public education and outreach, and we will be doing a lot of public outreach using a variety of means, including electronic media and the conventional ways of and holding workshops. The advisory councils will be involved in those.
You could get speaker slips up to the front. I'll have a sense of who's looking to speak, and we'll see if we can get some of the public comment in before lunch. Also, you could be thinking, if you're here to speak to this item and you can't come back after the lunch break, maybe you can think about that and make it clear, too, and we'll try to get your comments in before our noon lunch break as possible.
Windows. Okay, thank you very much. My name is Jeff Oliveira, and I'm an environmental specialist with the County Planning Department. And for my part here today, we'll be talking about the environmental determination for the land use and circulation element update that Mike and Chuck outlined for you. And just to start from the beginning, the adoption of this general plan element update triggers environmental review under CEQA. And what we're in for this project is what's referred to as a programmatic EIR. And just really briefly, the programmatic EIR could be compared to a more conventional project development EIR, where you actually have a proposal that includes actual physical development where you can analyze the impacts on the environment. We don't have the benefit for this project of knowing which projects will be built and when or where, so it'll be analyzed from a program level, which means we will help analyze what impacts are likely to occur by just implementing these policies. It'll be because we don't have the benefit of knowing exactly what will be built. We will tackle these impact issue areas from a general standpoint. And because of that general standpoint, we believe that doing an early scoping process would be beneficial because we have a good outline of where this project is headed, and we know that we're going to be looking at impact issues from a general standpoint. We feel that any input at this time would be helpful. And also, you know, experience with these program projects dictates that early input is really helpful at avoiding last-minute issues that could potentially result in recirculating an EIR. The benefits of avoiding those time and costly delays are self-evident. Next slide. Moving on, given our current project outline that Mike and Chuck introduced, what can we expect in this EIR? The focus of our environmental impact analysis will be elements of the land use and circulation update that could possibly result in increased densities or growth. These are areas where we know that development could result in potential impacts. In addition, that correlates to impacts related to what we call per capita growth. These are impacts that we know will be issues just from the general standpoint of increased densities in some of our urban areas. And that, for example, those are impacts related to, I listed a few here, water availability. I believe Mike mentioned traffic, and you can even associate air quality with that as well, public services and infrastructure and noise. And these are just a few examples based on experience that we know will need to be looked at closely in our program EIR. Next slide. Oh, we got it. So for our purposes here today, we're soliciting comments and input from our Planning Commission as well as the public and our stakeholders. What would be beneficial at this early phase would be to concentrate on input related to, for example, which issue areas, like I mentioned before, might be considered key given the goals that we've outlined in our update. And given those goals, we know that we're dealing with increased urban densities. You know, what impacts do you feel that need to be evaluated? Not just impacts, but what benefits? Strategic growth has benefits in and of themselves. By concentrating growth in urban centers, you could, for example, reduce, based on our collaborative efforts, staff can work on preparing and circulating a notice of preparation for the EIR. And at that time, it would be very appropriate to do additional scoping once more information is published and circulated to our population. Staff will work on gathering those comments based on the work we do on the final project description as well as the comments that we filter in as a result of issuing a notice of preparation. And from there, scoping the EIR becomes evident. And once we're at that point, we feel we can really nail down the issues that need to be focused in on in our environmental determination. Once we are able to scope that based on our collaborative efforts, staff will prepare a draft EIR for circulation to the public. Once we publish that EIR, staff will work on collecting comments based on that EIR and based on subsequent hearings we have here in the Planning Commission. Those will all be reviewed and addressed and answered in a final EIR that we'll be looking to
adopt along with a draft land use element update. And that, in a nutshell, is a overview of the environmental process, and that concludes my presentation. We have a slide here with contact information, and we encourage anybody that has questions to contact us directly and help us form what we think will be a successful process. And that concludes staff's presentation, and we're here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Olivera and Mr. Wilkin. I'd like to ask my colleagues to hold off maybe on any further questions for you, because I know I have a number of speaker slips here, and several people have been waiting patiently. So what I'd like to do is ask that anyone from the public who is here to speak on this item and can't return after lunch and would like to take the opportunity of a few minutes to speak before lunch, I'll invite you up now. So is there anyone who can't return who would like to go first? I see a couple of hands. So let's first invite Ms. Alkenicki from the Ag Department. It's Ag Commissioner's office is here. And we'll go from there. We have time for a couple speakers before lunch.
Good morning. Linda Kennecke, County Ag Department. Excuse me. I hadn't planned on speaking this morning because I felt that when I reviewed the staff report, the environmental issues broadly identified our concerns being environmental resources and policy inconsistencies. That was until I looked at the work plan. And within that work plan, I noticed task number 15, which is the strategic analysis, which says to identify strategies and actions to implement strategic growth, the conservation and open space element, the sustainable community strategy, and the climate action plan. And I thought, the vast majority of the land in this area is actually ag-zoned, and the ag element is not identified. I then went on to notice that task number 25 mentions visions and strategies that says to take into account strategic growth principles, the conservation and open space element, the climate action plan, sustainability, and economic considerations. Once again, the vast majority of the land is zoned agriculture, and there's no mention of the ag element. Thought that was a little unusual. And then I went to look at task number 26, which identified the public review draft that would take strategic growth into consideration, the conservation and open space element, etc. So I thought, well, that could imply the ag element. And the points that I'd like to make is, for the purposes of the scoping session, we do need to, at a minimum, look at AGP 11, 17, 18, and 24. There could be more following as the plan evolves. And more importantly, at this point in time, I'd like to remind you all that the ag element is going to be a standalone document, but it has not been demoted to et cetera. So at no time do I want the element forgotten. Thank you.
So noted, et cetera. Okay, and with that, are there other speakers? Please come on up, identify yourself.
James Kilmer, San Luis Obispo. I represent Caltrans Development Review. I'd just like to inform the Planning Commission that Caltrans is very interested in the process, the formal process of the update, for the county to simplify and consolidate its land use element and address strategic growth principles in the county. Like the county, Caltrans is charged with accommodating regional and local traffic, but we're also charged with the driving public.
Right. I would like a little more detail on how the review of the property owner requests will be incorporated into the programmatic review. Maybe hear from Mr. Olivera as well on that. Specifically, if certain requests are recommended by staff for denial, will their impacts be excluded unless the projects are subsequently approved? And if so, would the approval require a subsequent EIR? Then given current differing standards in the many planning areas, let's use an example like creek setbacks. Will there be a recommendation for standardized setbacks countywide? And if so, will they migrate toward the current narrowest or toward the current widest? And then will the EIR baseline still be what is on the ground now as opposed to what could have happened under the old standards in the various area plans. And I'm hoping it will be what's on the ground now, because that's where CEQA should start. Relative to the identification of least constrained areas outside urban and village reserve lines, will the AIR include an alternative project in its alternatives analysis in which all the growth is contained within those lines, given that that's the direction our strategic growth policy should be leading us? The answer I'm hoping for is that yes, it will. We need to measure these outside areas against, be able to measure the difference in impact between staying inside the lines and outside the lines, even if we're identifying places that are less impactful than they might be outside those lines. Then what assumptions about growth inside these lines will be the basis for the rural area impacts from traffic levels and resultant air quality, greenhouse gas, and level of service issues? Most of the traffic generation will be inside the lines where we're not actually updating yet, but the impacts will be felt outside the lines. So based on what assumptions? Just the old community plans, or will there be some new work done? What assumptions about cluster policies will be used? Are those likely to be resolved soon enough? I know that there is a notice of preparation on an apparently extremely impactful look at those cluster policies. And then a final quick request. On biological resources, I would like to see special emphasis on the deep-soiled valleys, because they anchor the food chain. They are also the most valuable agricultural soil, so they should be the last place we put development. They may not be as scenic as high crags, but biologically they are critical. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Anyone else here? We have 5 minutes, so one more speaker before lunch. We have Mr. Lee, CAL FIRE. Come on up.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, Chair Member, and Planning Commission. My name is Paul Lee. I'm your new fire marshal. Just wanted to introduce myself and express to you how interested we are in working with this EIR focus group. As with any project that is going to involve more people into the rural area, that is a response area of ours, we'd like to work hand in hand. It was just brought up not too long ago about the Ag Cluster subdivision. We've also commented on that. We'd like to continue to work hand-in-hand with that project as well. As the development goes on in the county and rural areas, we're very focused on getting that, or would like to comment on where that is in relation to our fire stations. And obviously, we don't always have the choice on where that's going to be. But to bring forth to the table that a new station with staffing may need to go into those new areas where the increase in population comes up where there isn't right now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. With that, does staff want to make just any brief comments at this point before we close for lunch?
I think we'll wait until afterwards so we can conclude our meeting before 12 in order to save additional costs.
So with that, I'll hold off. If commissioners will hold off questions or comments until after lunch, we'll re-adjourn at 1:30.
Yes.
Good afternoon. We will reconvene this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. We are in the middle of our item 3 scoping session on the update of the land use and circulation elements, and we are in the middle of public comment right now. I have one more speaker slip here. If anyone else from the public is here to speak to this item, we would appreciate that you fill out a speaker slip and come to the podium next. Mr. Wynn, you're next up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Commissioners. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm representing the Napomo Community Services District, but established by law, they have equal populations, and they could be used conceivably and still get the same benefit of 5 instead of 15 planning areas. Third, it's important for us to know in Napomo whether the EIR is going to be based on the assumption that the stipulated settlement that the county signed is going to be adhered to or not. specifically in the northern cities management area, which is everything north of Napomo up to Pismo, the stipulation stated that there would be no new wells. The county's a signatory to this, yet in the 5 years since that was signed, a number of new wells have been permitted by the health department, and the difference in the impact on the environment, if there are going to be no new wells, it's one set of impacts. If there are going to be new wells, it's a different set of impacts. And just to correct briefly, if I might, nomenclature used in the staff report, there is no Napomo Mesa water management area. There are two different names. The Napomo Mesa management area was created by the court with jurisdiction over the groundwater dispute, and that is what it is. It's what the court said. There is a Napomo Mesa water conservation area, which was created by the Board of Supervisors, and I suspect that's the area that you would like to talk about. These are very, very similar, but they're not precisely the same boundaries. Fourth, it would be important, I think, to have an alternative analysis of the new planning areas being identical with the water planning areas which are crafted by the Public Works Department. They have 15. They have slimmed down, but they're still down to 15 currently. There would be greater efficiency, of course, resource analysis, communications would be simplified. Both planning and public works would be on the same page when it came to analysis. Whether or not this is done in the EIR, at least it could be in the scoping. It could be one of the alternatives that you considered.
Excuse me, Mr. Wynn, I know the time says you're at. We'll give you another 3 minutes since you're representing two agencies here.
Five, will the EIR reference the approved EIR for the now abandoned affordable housing ordinance or not? If it's going to be referenced, you need to take into consideration that this is currently under challenge legally. On the other hand, if this EIR could totally replace it, that would be a good thing. And it would be helpful for us to know if that's what the EIR will do. Sixth, although the incorporated cities URLs and village reserve lines will not be changed significantly, a programmatic EIR must include the changes outside of those lines, but also must include those inside. CEQA does not allow us to piecemeal and do this in two different sets of CEQA analysis. Next, seven, water sources on your staff report, it's on section 3-5, needs to include both water supply and water infrastructure. It might be easier for the EIR to evaluate water basins that have current resource capacity studies completed, but there are many of other places that simply do not have those, and it's going to be problematic. To come back with CEQA and simply say there's not enough data or we don't know is not an acceptable answer under the California Environmental Quality Act. Eight, openly disclose, please, the names, the lists of the shirt-tail GPAs are going to be attached to the EIR. We understand why that those are allowed, and that's important, but we need to know what they are. Ninth, will TDCs be reactivated to function within a much larger planning areas? They scare us. And 10, will a class 1 impacts for water supply in coastal areas where seawater incursion is highly likely or in some places ongoing now, will those be exempt from findings of overriding consideration? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Anyone else here from the public who'd like to speak to this item? It's the last speaker slip we've received. Okay. No one coming forward, then I'll bring it back to staff for comments on anything that we've heard so far.
Sure. Good afternoon. Jeff Oliveira, environmental specialist. What I'll do is go through the comments that I took notes on. It seemed like there were a lot of them were based on the environmental impact analysis, and I'll let Mike chime in where appropriate. But I'll start off. There was a comment from Linda Kinnicky addressing concern about consistency with policies and the ag element. Policy consistency analysis will be analyzed across the board in this EIR as required. There were a couple statements about wanting to be, if it's merely just a zone change, you know, we'll have to analyze that with the information that we're given. If there's no actual project proposed or discussed, we see that as we'll need that project, if it triggers environmental review, we'll need subsequent CEQA. So it just depends on the level of information the property owners want to give us or if they have concrete plans. But yes, it'll be analyzed in the EIR. There was a question about baseline on-the-ground conditions versus an analysis between the current general plan element and the newly proposed update. The answer to that will be both. CEQA requires us to analyze the impacts based on a snapshot in time of what's been built on the ground, and we need to look at it from that standpoint, but also there's, say for a vacant parcel, there's the difference between what would be allowed under today's rules versus what would be allowed under this update. So I guess the short answer is we'll probably have to look at both. There was a question about alternatives in the EIR and whether or not the constraints map that we discussed will help determine alternatives and whether an alternative would be considered dealing with increased urban densities. And the answer is yes, we will be analyzing alternatives to the proposed update. At this time, we haven't scoped out the specifics of those alternatives. In our experience, project alternatives evolve as you're drafting your impact analysis, and they tend to rise to the top and become a little bit more obvious as we go. But the benefit of this early scoping process is that we hear this idea and input, and we can run with that for sure. I believe there's another question related to biological impacts. I believe it was referencing soils that support sensitive status species and habitat. That will all be considered as part of the EIR, soils as well as biological impacts. Moving along, I'm sorry.
So there, before you move on, just two more questions Mr. Greening raised, maybe meriting some response. What assumptions about cluster policies will be used?
I might let Mike.
I'll handle that after Jeff has finished going through the environmental issues.
Better you. Okay, separately. And then there was a question about recommendations for countywide creek setbacks.
Yeah, that's right. I do recall hearing a question about consolidating maybe more of a consistency between creek setbacks and those requirements. Again, that's another benefit of this early scoping process. I can't comment right now on current inconsistencies, but we took note of that, and that'll be something that we definitely want to look at as part of the EIR analysis. Moving on, Mr. Nguyen had several comments related specifically to the impact analysis, and I'll go through these, but again, if I leave anything out, just let me know. There was a question about the Climate Action Plan and AB 32 being addressed, and the answer to that is yes. I think the question was focused around vehicle miles traveled, and the short answer is yes. We will be looking at consistency with that legislation, as well as the analysis of the Climate Action Plan, which all kind of encompasses issues around vehicle miles traveled. There was a question about stipulations for no new wells. I think some of our northern communities were used as examples. And I can't comment on that. I'm not familiar with that stipulation, but we took note of that, and that will definitely be addressed in the EIR. Staff, on a side note, anticipates water being a central issue to our impact analysis based on our experience in the past with other ordinances and updates, and we intend to pay some attention to the water issues. And then there was a On that note, the comment about clarifying water district boundaries, that's another note that that staff will run with in the EIR. There was a comment about, and I believe it was a suggestion for an alternative that discusses realigning new community planning areas to be consistent with water management areas. Again, that's a valuable comment, and we analyze both water supply and water infrastructure in the EIR. That's a good clarification between supply and infrastructure. They both play into water impacts, and staff anticipates looking at both issues. And I believe there was a question about Class 1 impacts or significant and unavoidable impacts for coastal water, and you know, at this time we don't have the information to determine what impacts will be considered significant and unavoidable, so that's something that we will be working on through the EIR process, and again, involving our stakeholders like the RAC and our communities with water issues as well. So that completes my notes. Again, if there's anything I left out, let me know, and I'll turn it over to Mike at this time.
Thank you, Jeff. I'll start off with the question from Eric Greening that was mentioned before, and that has to do with assumptions about growth in urban areas. And the assumptions that we will use will be consistent with those of the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. So we'll be using their projections. As far as build-out in urban areas and village areas, we'll be taking another look at the build-out projections in those areas compared to what we have in our community plans right now. So we're going to evaluate where we are now on the ground in the urban areas and see really how much more capacity those areas have left, because it may be a little bit different than the numbers that are in our existing community plans, which were generated in some cases quite a while ago. So we do want to do that. There was a question about assumptions about the ag cluster policies. Well, that's a work in progress, so we'll be able to incorporate any changes in those policies as we can, but since that's kind of a moving target, we just have to see where we are in the process and incorporate as we can. There was a question or a comment about advisory councils taking on a larger role, and I wanted to focus on this for a minute. As part of our update, we'll be consolidating planning areas, but in some cases planning areas may get larger, but we don't see any change in the role of the advisory councils or their area of interest, or you know how much area or territory they cover. That should all remain the same under this update. We don't have any intention of changing advisory council areas of interest or the way they operate. There was a comment about an alternative to the planning areas, the fewer sub-regional planning areas being 16 or so water planning areas that the Public Works Department is looking at as part of their water master plan. And we've actually been working with the Public Works Department to make our sub-regional planning areas consistent with the approach that Public Works has taken. Now, there aren't 16, which would actually be an increase from the number of the planning areas we have now, which would kind of defeat the purpose of what we're trying to accomplish. But what we have done is sit down with Public Works staff and try to come up with boundaries that make sense and that correspond or align fairly closely to the regional water planning area boundaries that Public Works is looking at. So there is some consistency there, and I think the planning area boundaries that we come up with will be useful from that standpoint, but we don't anticipate going higher up to 16 from 15. Let's see. There was a question about TDCs, use of TDCs. Again, that's a work in progress, so we can incorporate can any changes to the TDC program in our assumptions. And I think that's all I had in my notes. Were there any additional ones that you would like addressed? Any additional comments or comments that your commissioners have or questions?
Probably. So a couple other things, then I heard questions from Mr. Greening and Mr. Wynn. Just wanted maybe some response, hadn't heard, to Mr. Wynn's question about, I guess it was probably just so noted, the impact or benefit from three districts being the same as supervisorial districts.
I suppose that's something we can look at. That approach doesn't have the advantage of following watershed boundaries to better enable watershed planning, but it's something, I guess, that there's some logic to that, and we can
look at concerns of how we do planning in the county, and where we, I think, find some areas of agreement. I think I would want to point out, in the article, for instance, it talks about the Home Builders Association believes smart growth should be designed for each community individually, which we agree and we will be looking at, that the county should approach planning with the idea of sustaining existing unique community character while clearly identifying areas where that growth and community expansion will be accommodated for the next 10 to 20 years. And that, I would just remind us, that's exactly what this effort is. So we share some of the other concerns that the building industry is expressing, but we're in alignment on at least the major piece, which is we need to plan for each community growth for the next 10 to 20 years and in a manner that reflects its current and projected character. So we're in agreement with that. They also, lastly, continue to urge the county to slow down, get more input from all the stakeholders, and find a solution we can all support. We think a two-year process is slow enough, but we're really key, as Mike indicated earlier, we're really keen on the idea of expanding the way we outreach to the public and giving them an opportunity to feedback in the process other than just coming to a workshop. Many people find that those are not convenient for them, and so there are other tools through the media, for instance, and online survey work that we can solicit community input and participation in a less traditional way. So we're surprised they're not here, but expect that they will be at future meetings.
Madam Chair, I just found another item in my notes that I didn't address, and that was a comment which I really didn't fully understand, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. It's a comment about coastal areas possibly being exempt from overriding considerations, and I think what I can say is that if there are going to be significant adverse impacts that they can't be mitigated, and the decision makers want to approve the project, they have to make a statement of overriding considerations. I don't think there are any exemptions from that under CEQA.
Are there questions? Any more questions for Mr. Olivera, Mr. Wilkin, Mr. Stevens?
Excuse me, cough drop. Timing could have been better. But I see scope is environmental, and it talks about promoting economic development, talks about housing, land use, linking land use and transportation. Does this also include the environmental impacts of commercial and industrial development?
Well, I'll let Mike comment as far as the scope of the update, but if that's included in the scope, then yes, we'll be looking at that in the EIR. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Yes, since this is an update of the rural areas, the rural unincorporated areas of the county, there won't be very much of the commercial and industrial development that will be on the table, but to the extent that there is, those impacts will have to be looked at. For example, in areas that are identified as least constrained, that where there could be a future expansion of urban or village areas, In such areas, there might be a combination of residential and commercial and employment-generating uses. So to the extent that there is, then the EIR would need to look at potential impacts of maybe additional growth in those areas.
And keeping in mind it's that programmatic level of analysis.
Other questions? Other questions to my left?
No.
Okay, well, with that, this isn't an action item. This is a scoping session, so our job was to listen and to receive and file comments. So if there are no more questions on this item, then we will close it and thank staff for the work. We'll look forward to what comes ahead, much ahead. So thank you for your work on this. And we'll also be interested to hear and see how you're encouraging public comment then and increase collaboration as you go. Participation. Thank you. And so with that, do I have a motion to receive all information we've received and enter it into the record? A second?
Oh, second.
Okay. With that, we will close this meeting.